Hi, and welcome back to the Beauty of Conflict podcast. We know you're busy, and we want to make it easy for you to understand how conflict may likely be showing up in a way that's impacting your team negatively. We've recorded the first three chapters of our book for you to listen to for free. Get your free audio sample at thriveinc.com/free sample. That's thriveinc.com/freesample.
Welcome to the Beauty of Conflict. I'm Susan Clark.
And I'm Chris Campbell.
And today we are going to have a conversation with you about the challenge of change. And how this comes up for me is often people talk about changing. And I don't really know. First off, I think it's important to define change and think about what it means to you, because sometimes it's usually not just an event that occurs and you're done. Like, okay, you give up alcohol and you, that's it. You never do it again. There are those people that maybe that happens for, but let's just face it, that's not usually how it goes. And I think often it's not so much change as in I never do something again, but my consciousness about what I'm doing shifts and my relationship then shifts to just making, it's no longer just unconscious choices. I'm actually choosing. And that's a whole different way of looking at change. So we wanted to have a conversation about that today and share some of our thoughts and perspectives on it.
So I was thinking about just my process of change over the last 2 years, but even 4 years with my adult children of alcoholics 12-step program, but the last 2 years with my rewiring dynamic neural retraining system, and this last year with Dr. Joe meditations, I have been trying to, and this has been a lifelong thing, to try to find some peace inside of me, some sense of safety, really, so that I have more choice. I have more, not feel like I'm being batted around by the winds of whether people like me or not, that approval out there. And I was thinking about what you were saying about choice, Susan, because what it can look like a change out there. I want to make more money or get in shape and all that. And what I've realized over the course of these 4 years is that it's really about how my relationship with myself and how I treat myself is the major change that I'm making. But I wouldn't have, if I've been peeling back an onion and getting in deeper and deeper to inside of me, those habits, those internal habits to be critical, mean, disassociate, be focused on you versus me, all those are wired into my nervous system. And so the idea of changing them is one thing. The actual process of change and then the experience of having it change is a much longer process that I've experienced, but it happened.
Oh, yeah. I think it's so interesting because a lot of times when I'm working with someone or coaching someone around a change they want to make in their life, the way they figure out whether they have some criterion of success. And then I go through that, through my own thing around that, around diet or weight. It's the scale that tells me whether I was successful, something outside of me that tells me my success. And generally speaking, that's a very rocky road. It doesn't, I might be successful for a little while, and then all of a sudden that scale's creeping up and I'm no longer feeling successful in my change path. What I think of it more from my own internal place, and I've been on a similar process to you over these last few years, thanks in part to how you bring me along. I think I fly along with you through. And what I've realized is it's really been these little things that I've, oh, wait a minute, I'm not as reactive. I'm more responsive. And that right there is really, to me, fundamentally where change, the relationship to change exists, in that dynamic between reaction and response. And if I can get that it's not a good, bad thing, it just is a thing. And beginning to pay more attention to when did I do it responsively, which is consciously with some form of consciousness, and when did I do it reactively based upon reaction, usually based upon survival and old historical patterns. And to me, that's a big difference between when I can not make even that right or wrong, just, oh, there's different choices. Yeah.
I love that you're saying that, Susan, noticing those subtle shifts, and it's like a trim tab on the boat. Like the trim tab is the tiny rudder that turns the rudder of a giant ship. That little trim tab change creates so much big course changes. And another reason this came up for both, tell me if I'm wrong, Susan, but you and I, is that we've been coaching executives and we pulled back an old book from Marshall Goldsmith, What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And it's all about these unconscious interpersonal habits that even though somebody's really great, they're doing something that's getting in their way in their relationships. That's one way of looking at habits. We look at habits in a much broader sense. And how often, because we are not aware of our habits, they are unconscious. They're part of our unconscious bias. We do whatever we do, eat the way we do, react to conflict or criticism those ways, because we think it's helping us survive. But what you said, Susan, is these are old survival mechanisms that we learned way young. We're not conscious we're doing them. They're not working. And we're not aware of it until we get some negative feedback from the outside world or a health crisis or job crisis, whatever it is. She goes, wait a minute, something's got to shift here.
Oh, I'm with you. I think that's a big piece of what too often it is something, a crisis that creates a change. And that's just boring. Painful. Why do you need to wait for that? And also, I love this idea of the known versus the unknown is another way. An interesting way to be thinking of it, because the known patterns of my life are just the things I've done habitually. Some of them are great. But when I start to appreciate kind of the unknown and the idea of this is like the mystical, that word that, you know, or the idea of the invisible forces in the world that I learned not to pay any attention to because I want to control everything. And there's this rigidity. And if I can let go of that control and recognize that invites me into the unknown. And think about it, that's the most exciting time. That's what's so cool about watching an infant. They're in awe because they're like, oh my God, wow. And wouldn't you like to live like that longer? Because that's really what they're thriving on, is they're the juice of the unknown, the kind of the awe of something new every day. And we've lost that by trying to get control. And
I think you're bringing up such a good point, because that baby it's building its neural map inside, because our habits are controlled by our nervous system and our brain. And the whole idea of everything in our life has a neural map. So my relationship to my dogs, my house, you, how I exercise, where the coffee shop I go to, all these things have space, real estate in my brain. And I just keep going to the same neighborhoods, the known. Even our personality is like this tiny little box inside our brain. We have so much more of our brain. And we keep staying in the same neighborhoods because we know it. It feels comfortable. It's familiar. And it's concrete. That little baby doesn't have any neighborhoods in their brain quite yet, except mama's womb. And so
on that note, okay. Before you go any further, because I love, it's true. Baby brains, one, they haven't built that neural map and they're not going to for a while. Their brain actually activates on imagination and other ways of thinking, not this neocortex that puts all this logic together for quite a while. And yeah.
Well, I think it's actually 6 or 8. They don't have an analytical filter. So their brain waves are like in theta and that's why they sleep all the time when they're really young. Then they move into delta, which is dreamy, and alpha, imagination. We live in beta, which is high stress, go. And that's that analytical brain that's saying, this is good, this is bad. I've figured this out. And we think everybody thinks the same way we do. We don't. We've all created our own filter inside. That it's like a big database table that says these things are good, these things are bad, very black, white thinking. And yes, but little baby and young children are not, but the kind of the downfall of that is they take in everything as a sponge. So if they say good girls don't talk, that's truth. Okay, good girls don't talk, or boys don't cry. Okay, boys don't cry. And all that are just beliefs. They're not actual real, but young children absorb that. And so that becomes part of their filter as they age and grow up, as we age and grow up.
And so this whole idea you're talking about in terms of the neural pathways and naps, and I think this comes into play too with the idea that as adults, when we've gone to where we are now and we're much more using our neocortex than I'll be the rest of our brain, let's put it frankly, yes. Except for the amygdala, but just constantly keeping us safe, which we may not even be paying attention to how it's wired to be doing that all the time. But, and the idea that if we began to get the knowledge and start to understand how our brain is working, then if we can begin to acquire that knowledge and build a base for that knowledge, then we might be able, that may help us with this change process, because we have the ability to entertain the idea that we do have different neural pathway, a map, and we can get to come into some understanding of that.
I think that's so true, Susan. Understand, like when I first started my rewiring process, which is this, I do an hour a day of this piece, and I'd close my eyes and this is just one way a neural map works, my particular neural map. I close my eyes and I'd see my body, but my sense was like 2 feet to the right of me and in front of me. And my left hips were like, I'm just making this up, but they were all over the place. Like my left hips were maybe behind me. It didn't. And I'm like, that's not how I'm built. I'm like, if I close my eyes, if I could turn my eyes, I'd be all in this column below me. That's what should happen. And that wasn't, I felt like they were in all these different compartments. And as I've actually done the rewiring piece, the Joe meditation, which he does this thing where you're putting your attention on these different chakras, it's like my neural map for just my body has come so much more into an alignment that it is more of a column below me. But I would have never known that my body was so in my brain, so disjointed.
And I think why another piece to add to this for the brain and knowledge part of it is that our brain is where a lot of the synapses and firing is going on. That is really thought is not substance. It's just
energy.
It's information. Yeah. It is truly where all universal energy exists, everything. And in that space, there is no thing, no time, no, it's just all. And that we can't conceptualize that once we get here in this body, because we've already spent a lot of time becoming separate and our own personality and everything else. But our brain has the capacity to fire in such a way that it can get to that information. And that information is infinite and actually not judgmental. So that's a bit of a gap too.
I think you're bringing up a point that many people would be like, what the heck is she talking about? Because we are in this linear time. We're in a body, we're in polarization, but our brain, I think what you're saying, Susan, is our brain has the capacity to run higher and higher frequencies. We're all sorts of imagination out of time. People that have had experiences where they are like, oh my God, I'm in a whole different place. Or even dreaming is a form of leaving our body, time, and environment and going into some place. And I think, like I was saying, our personality is this tiny little real estate in the neocortex of our brain. We just haven't activated parts of our brain. Our pineal gland can activate and it can actually fire. So we're taking higher frequencies, processing gamma frequencies, which is more like a universal love. And it feels very different in the body than our beta. Oh my God, I got to get this done because I don't have enough time, which we spend so much of our living waking hours in that state.
Yes.
Yes.
I think what you're trying to articulate, because I think you're like, hey, people are probably listening to you, Susan, and thinking, why are she's gone into the land? And I'm not, I think.
This is science-based, by the way. There's science behind all this.
I was really just talking about the fact that in our bodies, we have chemical reactions. We have electrical reactions. That's actually how our body functions. I really was bringing it down to the science we know and love.
Okay.
Not just the things that have become like, even though I like those too. But that's really how our body functions, through chemical reactions and electrical synapses. And the brain is where that electrical part is happening. It's much less than our neural system, our nerves. And our body has a lot of chemical reactions related to depression, various things that go on in the body organs and systems. And those things are very related to our emotional state and our mental state.
Yes. And I think what I was bringing in the different frequencies that run, like we predominantly are Hertzian frequencies in our body. But when we, like it, through our Dr. Joe meditations, there's a process where you're learning to actually activate and bring, not bring in, but allow your brain to process higher frequencies, which we have learned to screen out, not pay attention to. All those different frequencies fire different chemical, different electrical sequences, different chemicals in the body. And that's what I think you're saying. You can have joy or you can have depression. They're all related to frequency that we're running.
And if we had somebody else here who happened to be a pharmaceutical person, they would probably explain to you how that happens through the interaction with drugs, which is actually really working on the same system and it, in some respects. But we have within us also the capacity to, you want to call it your own inner pharmaceutical company. You have some access to that because of the nature of how we are interconnected inside ourselves and even amongst ourselves. So, yeah, on a broader.
I do think how this relates to my, even my adult children of alcoholics. So we grow up, there's the alcoholic who's the identified problem, but then there's what we call a para-alcoholic, which is the codependent. And the codependent actually lives on an inside drugstore of fear and pain. So both of them pass these things down to the nervous system of the children. Because when children are born, their nervous system isn't fully formed. They actually absorb the nervous system of their caregivers. So here, we grow up in a system that is resonating at these frequencies, and we imprint, our nervous system imprints on that. And so we develop an internal drugstore of fear and pain. However, what you're saying, Susan, is as we do more work, if we choose to, we can actually start to affect that inner drugstore and start to create different chemicals that some people take drugs for, but you can also self-create. And you can check this out in any of Dr. Joe's book, You Are the Placebo or Becoming Supernatural. He talks about how our pineal and our brain can make these chemicals that actually help us feel much better.
Yes. And even just breath alone does that.
Absolutely.
It introduces. So these are... all this information is out there, and there's a lot of knowledge, and you can get a lot of misinformation too. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to tell anyone.
And we're not medical experts.
But what we are suggesting is that if you do decide to begin to explore a path of acquiring your own knowledge base and understanding it from and researching it yourself, and also because the key is there's knowledge and then there's experience. Because if you just, we always talk about this when we talk to, when we're working with a team, we don't want to just give them a bunch of information and a training or theoretical perspective. We want them to actually then practice it with their real business issues and real life. That's the same idea. Get some information, have an experience. And that's actually what allows the body to have both that kind of, oh, light bulbs go off when you're getting theory. Chemicals go off in the body when you're in an experience and it's not comfortable or a joy or something. Yeah. So those things need to be happening. That's helpful to have them happening at the same time. And I was thinking about, there was a quote you sent me this week about, it takes 400 repetitions or something like that.
It takes 400 repetitions to change your synapses. However, to change your brain synapses is along a certain spectrum, something you're trying to change. It only takes 10 to 20 if it's done in play.
Now,
when you're playing,
you might be thinking, yes, what is that about? And it's because there is all this, your brain is a powerful tool. There's no question.
Yeah.
There's a lot of possibility in it. However, your heart and your emotional field is equally vital to, because I think that's what children access before they get all this need. They're just naturally in their being. And it's play is, I think, has more to do with joy and heartbeats than anything else. And it's all losing.
It's also about the body moving. You're not just studying it. You're not just reading a book. Reading a book is very valuable, but your bodies, you're laughing, you're connecting, you're all sorts of, all the systems, like you're saying, Susan, are operational. And so it's a full scale impact on the brain as opposed to just the rote learning.
I think the actual definition of play is activity without a specific purpose or outcome. And yeah. that's very hard for us adult people to grapple with. You know, like, I don't know very many people that exercise just because they love exercise. They exercise because it's good for them. And not that those things are wrong, but if you can actually imagine that, oh, moving my body should, it doesn't have to have a purpose. It just, yeah, just do it. See what happens.
I know that this kind of leads me to another idea that I wanted to talk about. I was thinking about if we could open people up and see their inner map, their inner neural map, what that would look like. Oh my gosh. And I was thinking about mine and how it's been changing. And again, I'm not like measuring it so much as just feeling the effects of, because I grew up being very self-critical, judgmental, perfectionistic, people-pleasing, all my adult children have alcoholic traits. And then what I've been, Kristen Neff has a great book, Self-Compassion, and it fits in with a Loving Parent Guidebook of ACA, Adult Children and Alcoholics. And it's this shifting of how we talk to ourselves. And most of us are unconscious, like you're saying, Susan, unconscious about how critical, mean, when something goes wrong, we're like, oh, you idiot. I can't believe you did that. Oh, you're so embarrassed. All those thoughts can go on for me. And I've started, and this really happened with reading Kristen Neff's book, like treating yourself like a best friend. Like, I imagine somebody putting their arm around me and whispering in my ear, you're doing just fine, especially when I'm trying to do something and I'm not doing it very well. And this shift from being critical and contemptuous towards myself, which I still am. However, I have a lot more moments where I'm compassionate and kind. And there is this, that's a whole different neighborhood to be in my brain. And a whole different inner relationship, which actually, it gets back to what you were saying about reacting and responding. When I don't stay in that reactive place, the refractory period of how long I'm out or suffering, it's, oh, that happened. I recover much more quickly, which means I can get up and try again or go a different direction or engage with people, where all those other things, I might just more collapse and go, okay, I don't want to play or participate.
I mean, so. I just think about what you're saying in terms of if it's a good thing we didn't have that contempt and criticism of ourselves when we were little. Just imagine no one would ever walk. We would have never walked because that is a process of
falling. And you idiot, you know, I can't believe you haven't figured out how to walk.
Imagine if that's what was going on in a baby's head.
You should be very embarrassed. Oh my gosh, people are watching. You know,
yes. And what's sad is that by the time we get into school, we actually are beginning to hear those voices all the time. And our brain is sucking it up and taking it in. And we do become our own worst critics. But I like that idea that you could be contempt or compassion. Like, it's always like those continuums, since just about everything is polarized. You may as well get rid of the continuum and then realize it's really not good or bad. It's movement. How do I move on this continuum? Not, and that to me is change, is really movement. It's not from here to there. It's because that's just flipping the coin. I went from good to bad or bad to good. But when you actually begin to understand that it's movement, then it's, oh, change is about fluidity, about being in some sort of flow versus rigid, tight all the time.
I really like that because obviously I have still have the pattern. It's more, wow, I also notice this other voice and how nice that is. I want more of that, but I certainly go back. So it is that fluid. And what you were saying earlier, Susan, I'm much more conscious. This critic used to just run me. I just thought that was me. Not, there was no choice. I beat myself up because that's what you do. So now I have more choice. Wait a minute. I could actually have that arm go around me. Oh, that's right. I'm doing just fine. And so I really get, so often I want you to be different, Susan. You treat me differently or whoever it is. But this one person just treat me differently. And really, I am recognizing more and more that my biggest, most impactful relationship is the one to myself, the voices. How I treat me on an everyday basis, even in transitions. This is my current thing. I realize I go from one thing to the next and I'm like, wow, what if I just paused to breathe? If I took a minute, it would be a shift. So those small changes that can make a big shift.
I think, and I know we're going to have to wrap it up soon. Sometimes when we talk to each other, we can go on for a very long time. But I think one of the things that for me, I want to bring in here at the end is that one of the biggest obstacles, and you just brought it up, was this notion of our relationship to time. our relationship to our own personality, our history, our body, and our relationship to our environment. Those three things are often, we don't even pay much attention to how that is hardwired at this point into who we are there, and realizing that's where we have the most possibility of beginning to shift our relationship to those three things. We, instead of making it about another person, it's okay, wait a minute, I'm making this about time. I don't have enough time to do this. What if that's not the factor? What if time is actually something, as it might just be, that's relative, relativity. What is it? And that becomes totally different. My relationship to time, I have some choice. My relationship to my history, I have choice. My relationship to my environment, I have choice. But it's hard.
I think it's a cultivation, that choice point. I have had to develop enough presence where I even start to recognize, oh, I could actually not please you and stay connected to me. And I'm not going to get attacked, or maybe you'll get upset, but that still doesn't, you're not going to physically beat me up or anything, like those old belief systems. But that is a cultivation. And it's a cultivation that is my life's purpose, and I'm totally committed to it. But I think that's that level of commitment, I believe, one needs to actually engage in the process of change, because changing habits, unconscious habits, takes time and commitment. And I guess a big why, like even when you were saying people exercise because it's good for you, but really having a why that matters.
I can't help but you gave me a lead line for my, because okay. What it makes me think of is how often people talk about the notion of freedom and how important freedom is. And yet really to me, and I think I quoted a Nelson Mandela thing recently on his comments about freedom, and that it really is, there's not freedom until you realize that it's not enough just to get rid of your own chains. You actually have to be willing to live a life that is responsive and aware of the impact and enhances other people's lives. And I think that's important, even if you don't care about other people, which I imagine there are people out there that are pretty self-involved, but they want freedom for whatever reason. I've yet to meet somebody who doesn't on some level. They might fight for it differently than I would, but when I get to our bigger why, there's something about freedom, but it doesn't mean freedom without some awareness of the impact you might be having in your world. And I think when we get that, it becomes a whole different thing, an incredibly important why.
I was thinking about, and I know we're ending, but I was thinking about some people think, okay, freedom, I just need enough money and then I'll be free. And that's what a lot of people pursue to the detriment of all those around them. And I've been guilty of that. No, I just need as much money and that's what's going to keep me safe and free. But eventually, money may be one thing. You have health, relationships, like there are other qualities that we start to recognize, wait a minute, and this is a time-limited experience, life. And so when those factors start to come in, oh, I won the game, I have all the money, but oh, where are my people and where's my life? And that's when the bigger question, and if we can come to that a little earlier, so we can make some different choices and be interested in the impact we're having. And I think that would be helpful. That's my wish for our world.
Okay. This has been fun. You're intrigued by some of the things.
I don't know. We don't know if you've enjoyed it, listeners, but we've enjoyed I'm
going to assume they had fun. And if they didn't, they probably turned us off. But if they've listened this long, there must have been a reason why they paid attention.
We'd love to hear from you, by the way.
Okay.
You can reach out to us at Thrive, THRIVE, at thriveinc.com, THRIVEINC.com. You can also leave a review on iTunes, Apple Podcasts.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Susan here. As a coach, a lot of my time is spent helping clients speak up in a direct and honest way in their relationships at home and at work. Chris Marie and I decided to create a speak up kit to help you do that for yourself. It's the best of our best work that we've gathered to help you. To learn more, go to thriveinc.com/speak up. That's www.thriveinc.com/speak up.